Don't know where the other airplane was struck, but struck his nose gear and left landing gear, sheared both of those off in the collision.
A mid-air crash north of Anchorage results in the death of a pilot. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Anchorage Assembly moves closer to turning the LIO building into police headquarters.
It's not like this building is haunted. It's just, it was a stupid move by the state and we get to take advantage of it.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at AlaskaHeart.com.
Investigators say two small airplanes collided in the air west of Anchorage about noon today. One plane crashed in water at the mouth of the Susitna River, killing one person on board, while the other was able to continue flying to Anchorage, where it made an emergency landing. Clint Johnson, head of the National Transportation Safety Board's Alaska region, says the pilot who landed the damaged Cessna 175 in Anchorage reported the planes were flying directly at each other.
He suddenly saw an airplane that was basically spinner to spinner, nose to nose. He made an evasive maneuver by pulling back on the yoke, which obviously the airplane climbed very quickly. There was a collision. Don't know where the other airplane was struck, but struck his nose gear and left landing gear, sheared both of those off in the collision. Then the second airplane descended uncontrollably into the waters of the mouth of the Big Sioux.
Johnson says the surviving pilot described the other plane as a high-winged Cessna, but had no better description than that. He says the NTSB believes the person who died was the pilot and sole occupant, but it remained unclear this afternoon if there were any passengers. Johnson says the deceased person's name is being withheld pending notification of next of kin. Governor Bill Walker today signed into law state budget bills but rejected funding for a South Central Alaska Bridge project and a vitamin D deficiency study. Walker vetoed $2.5 million for the dormant Kinnick Arm Crossing project. He also cut a roughly $500,000 study aimed at determining the prevalence of vitamin D deficiencies in pregnant women and babies. Walker said a similar study is ongoing. Walker signed legislation calling for limited structured draws from Alaska Permanent Fund earnings to help pay government costs. Walker's budget director, Pat Pitney, says Alaska's deficit has shrunk to about $700 million, which would be covered using savings. Oil prices will influence the ultimate size of that deficit. The new fiscal year starts on July 1st. Standard & Poor's has improved its outlook on the state's bonds from negative to stable. It took the action on Friday in part as a response to a new state law. The measure outlines a plan to drop money from Alaska Permanent Fund earnings to pay for state government. The improved outlook means the rating agency no longer expects to lower the state's credit rating. The rating affects how much the state must pay those who buy Alaska bonds. The lower the rating, the more the state must pay to borrow money. S&P analysts cited the law as one of several factors that led them to revise the outlook for Alaska. The law says the state can draw up to 5% of the permanent fund's value each year. The money can be used to pay for state government as well as for permanent fund dividends. Higher oil prices also contributed to the improved outlook. Governor Walker signed the law today. A program that provides millions of dollars in federal subsidies to help pay rural Alaska healthcare facilities' high internet bills has been on hold for nearly a year. Internet service providers have not been getting paid what they expected as the Federal Communications Commission conducts a rate review. The result for one facility, the Cordova Medical Center, was a shutoff notice due to an unpaid internet bill of nearly $1 million. Alaska Journal of Commerce reporter Naomi Clauda has been reporting on the delays with the FCC's rural health care program. She says the rate review came after the $400 million for rural health care programs across the country ran out.
That's what held up the payment. But it also triggered a rate review because the FCC realized they wanted to understand the rates. How do you justify these costs? What are you charging?
Naomi, give us a little perspective on this. $1 million internet bill. What's the range of what these hospitals and clinics are paying for service?
Well, for example, the Cordova Community Medical Center, because of the fees not getting paid by the FCC, Alaska Communication Services was really having revenue problems. One of the issues was in December, ACS laid off 30 workers, which was a fifth of its workforce. So they sent the letter to the Cordova Hospital and said, hey, you know, somebody's got to start paying these fees. And it cost roughly $1 million, not quite that. It was $800,000+. Now, each month is an $80,000 bill at the Cordova Medical Center in order to pay for their telemedicine, just that portion. Of that, because of the way that they wanted to make it fair for rural and urban medical facilities to not be paying these outrageous sums, they are subsidized by the FCC. So Cordova's portion was $1,060 per a month, which is pretty reasonable. So you've got about $12,000, $13,000 per year for that clinic, that hospital to pay. Now, the FCC portion of that was, you know, whatever would be left over, $78,000 per a month. That times 12, so that's how it ended up being almost $1 million. Imagine a facility that's much larger and serving more people, like the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation. They would be many, many times that amount.
Let's talk a little bit about what's at risk here. Rural healthcare providers need reliable high-speed internet. They're doing telemedicine. How much is that a part of rural health medicine now?
It's a huge part, and it really does save lives. We've heard lots of stories like, you know, we're talking about Fort Yukon or Brevik or places outside Kotzebue, that those cluster villages, the 56 villages outside of Bethel. We're talking down King Salmon. So, you know, there's something like 300,000 people, which is almost half of our Alaska population, that benefits from some form of telemedicine.
Naomi, you reported some movement on this issue recently. What's going on? What's the current situation?
So back to when there was the $400 million, you know, allotment, this pot of money that wasn't enough to stretch across the nation. You know, this was the amount of money that was allotted when the program was created in 1996. Now, $400 million is like a joke when it comes to all 50 states splitting that. So they appealed to the FCC and said, hey, you know, this needs to be raised somehow. And Chairman Pai listened. He's the, you know, head of the FCC. He decided just last week to go ahead and propose $571 million, which would be the amount if $400 million had kept up with inflation during those 20 years. That would be the exact amount it would be today. So that's under discussion right now. They'll be voting on it.
And in the meantime, they have said that the bills will be paid. Is that correct?
Yes. Then at that point, the FCC spokesman explained to me just this week that it would be 100% of whatever those invoices are. So going back to ACS and its, you know, $70,000+ per a month invoice to the Cordova Hospital, that would be repaid to ACS 100%.
Naomi Klauda is a reporter for the Alaska Journal of Commerce. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, students from Romig Middle School take their history project to the Smithsonian.
We put in so much effort, and we knew that it was like, we were like, that was a job well done because we spent so much time on it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, is awarding the city of Seward disaster relief after a storm in December severely damaged a road south of town. City Manager Jim Hunt says a strong tidal surge in the Gulf of Alaska combined with southerly winds sent waves crashing over Lowell Point Road.
We actually have waves coming up and over onto the road as it was eroding the roadbed.
Hunt says the waves also damaged RV parks near the city. FEMA announced last week it would pay 75% of repairs to the road. Hunt says the city still needs to assess exactly how much those repairs will cost.
You know, we're looking, you know, likely, you know, in the $4 to $5 million range. We're still, you know, trying to narrow down the exact cost for, you know, the FEMA participation.
The city will be required to pay for a quarter of the repairs, and it plans to have the road assessed by September. Hunt says it will still be drivable through the summer, and the city hopes to begin repairing the road right after the summer tourism season. Officials in Anchorage are one step closer to purchasing the embattled Legislative Information Office and using it to house the city's police department. As Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, the Anchorage Assembly passed a crucial vote on the matter last night.
The move allows for a semi-independent municipal agency, the Anchorage Community Development Authority, to buy the LIO for $14 million. That is substantially lower than the appraised value of $18 million. One of the reasons offered for the bargain pricing is the building's fraught political baggage. It drew criticism and condemnation for an expensive, opulent redesign that many criticized as inappropriate. That shadow, plus a lawsuit, ultimately caused state legislators to abandon it. Assemblymember Eric Croft says that after sitting vacant for almost 2 years, ACDA was right to pounce when it saw the opportunity for a deal.
Yeah, we know the history and the optics, if you will, but it's not like this building is haunted. It was a stupid move by the state, and we get to take advantage of it.
The administration of Mayor Ethan Berkowitz announced last week that the large downtown building could soon house the Anchorage Police Department. APD currently occupies a facility around 5 miles away in the UMED district that officials say it has drastically outgrown. Supporters say leasing the LIO building to the police department will save on the costs of building an entirely new headquarters, which officials estimate could be anywhere from $30 to $65 million. Assemblymember John Weddleton says having a tenant lined up calmed his concerns over the purchase.
I was not excited about it until I found out we're really buying something for the police department that we're going to have to buy anyway. I think the optics are really, really bad to put government stuff in this amazing Crystal Palace, but I'm willing to overlook that because this is a good deal.
Criticism of ACDA's purchase focused on the rapid process, which some felt left members of the public and business community out of the loop. Among assembly members, only Amy Domboski voiced serious opposition, saying that as long as the police department is potentially paying to lease the building, it's still taxpayers who are on the hook financially.
This is a rush job. I think it reeks of some sort of special favor. And at the end of the day, the taxpayers of Anchorage are going to take it in the shorts. Mark my words.
Domboski was joined in her no vote by fellow Eagle River Assemblymember Fred Dyson. The measure was overwhelmingly approved, 8-2, clearing a major hurdle for ACDA's purchase. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
The city and borough of Juneau is looking to the community for help meeting the remainder of its $1 million commitment to the University of Alaska's new education college. The city pledged to create an endowment when the university's Board of Regents was considering where to put the new school. KTOO's Adeline Baxter has more.
The city has already contributed $500,000 towards its $1 million pledge. Stock market gains and donations mean it's now worth a little over $600,000. The budget that takes effect July 1st includes another $250,000. Now, the city hopes to make up the remainder of its pledge, about $150,000, with community donations. Assemblymember Jesse Keel said the goal is to have 150 community donors make personal or business contributions.
It's important that the city started that off and started very strongly. And so this is an opportunity to broaden that throughout the community and get lots of people involved.
there have already been several $10,000 donations.
So we're in, and I know there are a lot of folks here in Juneau who recognize and appreciate the value of that College of Education being here.
The Alaska College of Education, based at the University of Alaska Southeast in Juneau, is now the administrative center for teacher education in Alaska. Although degree programs will continue at the Anchorage and Fairbanks campuses, the university hopes the new structure will help it reach its goal to produce 90% of Alaska's teachers by 2025. The UA Board of Regents approved $1.15 million for the new college at its May 31st meeting. UAS Chancellor Rick Caulfield said that money will support coordination among UA's teacher education programs, with UAS in the lead.
It's a significant investment by the regents of new funds into UAS and teacher education, and that'll include additional money for marketing and recruitment of students into our undergraduate and our graduate programs, our Master of Arts in Teaching program, for example.
The decision to base the college in Juneau was controversial. Its creation came out of Strategic Pathways, an initiative aimed at consolidating programs and saving money in the midst of state budget cuts. Fairbanks was the original recommendation, but Regents ultimately voted in December 2016 to base the school at UAS. That resulted in votes of no confidence in UA President Jim Johnson's leadership last year by the faculty senates at UAF and UAA. They said faculty was not consulted prior to the decision. Keel was one of the main cheerleaders in the push to choose UAS.
It was important that the University of Alaska Southeast take the lead on teacher education because it really was the most successful program, it was the most innovative, it was the most efficient.
Keel pointed out that the Fairbanks and Anchorage campuses have more master's degree programs than UAS. He said it's important for each of UA's three main universities to have areas of expertise.
Without that, the potential threats in the budget-cutting times to UAS as a standalone university were tremendous.
Besides its educational importance, the campus is also one of Juneau's biggest local employers and an economic driver in the region. Keel said there's no firm deadline for meeting the fundraising goal, but the sooner the fund is established, the better. Caulfield said the university looks forward to putting the CBJ Teacher Excellence Fund to work building future generations of Alaskan educators.
I envision that those funds will be used for scholarships and to support programs not only here in Southeast Alaska, but all over the state.
Summer programs at the Alaska College of Education are already underway. Steve Atwater, the new executive dean of the college, starts July 1st. In Juneau, I'm Madeline Baxter.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
It's well established that Arctic ice is changing in dramatic ways. As the climate warms, ice coverage is decreasing. The amount of multi-year ice has gone down significantly. And in Alaska, many communities are seeing the ice come in later and leave sooner. Ravenna Koenig of Alaska's Energy Desk recently took a trip onto the ice off of Utqiagvik and has this report on what some of those changes look like up close.
On an early evening in late May, about a dozen grad students and postdocs are standing at the northern edge of Utqiagvik, bundled up and waiting by a fleet of snow machines for one man to rumble their way.
Which way is Barrow?
Were you thinking of that line the whole way here?
Everyone, this is Dr. Craig George.
Craig George has been a wildlife biologist with the North Slope Burrow since the early 1980s. He spent literal months of his life on the ice in this part of Alaska, often camped out for days or weeks at a time, doing bowhead whale counts and helping to measure and sample whales during spring whaling. The other voice belongs to Andy Mahoney, an ice researcher at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He's been coming to Utqiagvik for the past 18 years to study sea ice.
Craig was there at the very beginning of my sea ice career, and I think...
During the Pleistocene.
Back in the Pleistocene, yeah. Back when ice used to be ice.
Yeah,
before this new ice that we've got now.
George and Mahoney are leading a group of science students on a snow machine trip out onto the Chukchi Sea. We whip over snow-covered lagoons, down the slope leading to the ocean, and over several miles of relatively flat ice close to shore. Then the surface gets rougher. We start to see big piles of broken ice. These are pressure ridges. They're created when big chunks of floating ice bump up against the shore-fast ice we're snow machining on, forcing it to crumble and push both up above the surface, which we can see, and down below it, which we can't. I asked Craig George how what we're looking at is different from what he saw out here decades ago.
The ice tells you what it's made out of when it formed. I mean, the ridges, see the thickness? So that's relatively thin first year. I haven't seen any multi-year.
Multi-year ice is ice that survived at least one summer. It's usually several feet thicker than the ice that forms and melts away in a single year.
First and second year ice looks like the Rockies, Rocky Mountains, and the old multi-year ice looks like the Appalachians, sort of rounded.
A few decades ago, 61% of the ice on the Arctic Ocean was multi-year ice. Now, it's about half that. One reason that multi-year ice matters is that it's one of the ways the Arctic stays cold. Ice reflects heat from the sun, while water traps it. So if a ton of ice stops being ice during the summer and instead becomes water, the Arctic is going to get warmer, which means it won't be able to help keep the rest of the Earth cool. We clamber up a 20-foot pressure ridge. Before us is a seemingly endless field of ice rubble, sharp blue shards jutting up in every direction. No rounded Appalachians here. The lack of multi-year ice doesn't just mean that certain shapes are jagged when they used to be round. Andy Mahoney says it helps explain why the landscape looks different in other ways.
These ridges that we're standing on, there would have been more of them and they would have been bigger. So it really has changed. I mean, you look back at some pictures of that era and the features that we now see, they're sort of something of a shadow from the past.
There are other changes too. The ice here is forming later, and in some places this year was record thin. But that doesn't necessarily translate to a bad ice year for people who depend on the ice, like hunters. Yes, it means the window of time to hunt certain animals is shorter. But when it comes to the ice conditions that make for a good whaling year, wind, currents, and weather play a huge role too.
Weather plays a big factor in our hunt, and this year the weather was pretty windy.
That's Joseph Levitt, a whaling captain.
Pretty windy, but we had our ice stayed solid. There was hardly any current on the ocean. And so it turned out to be a good year. At least we got eight whales.
Billy Adams is a whaler who works for the North Slope Borough Wildlife Department. He says that, yes, ice is freezing later, and yes, parts are thinner. But even as they see changes in the ice, whalers are adapting.
We just make changes to how we're going to hunt and when we're going to hunt. That's the biggest thing.
Even as the ice continues to change, whalers say they will keep finding ways to bring whales home to the community. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik.
Applying the lessons from the past are at the heart of a student contest that sent Alaska kids to the East Coast. 41 students from across Alaska headed to Maryland this week to compete in the National History Day contest. They're joining students from across the country and the world. As part of the contest, a team of eighth graders from Anchorage has also been invited to showcase their exhibit about the Berlin Wall at the Smithsonian today. Alaska Public Media's Aaron McKinstry has more.
13-year-old Annika Kohlberg and 14-year-old Ava Lyles are struggling to piece their National History Day exhibit together with the help of their mothers.
Yes.
They managed to fit the gray boards on top of one another. The exhibit stands taller than they do, and they aren't short.
We have two trifold boards. The top is more of the information that we needed to have for our project, so more facts. And then the bottom, we have split west and east with quotes and photos from kind of each side of the wall.
Kohlberg points out the timeline, which is decorated with string lights and runs horizontally. In one of the photos, a guard reaches through a gap in the Berlin Wall, offering a flower to the camera. John F. Kennedy's quote, "A wall is a hell of a lot better than a war," is centered on the board in big, bold letters.
Another one from Reagan, "We don't mistrust each other because we're armed. We're armed because we mistrust each other." And I think those are also things we can be applied currently, kind of realizing our faults, like as we're talking before, like learning from our mistakes and what works and what doesn't.
On the floor, a small replica of the Berlin Wall made of styrofoam splits the board into east and west. Lyles explains.
And one half of the wall has graffiti on it because it shows how people from the west side were able to come up to the wall and ride on it, and how on the east side it was just one blank wall because everything was restricted.
Even though Kohlberg and Lyles, along with their Romig middle school classmates Liza Lebo and Emma Knapp, spent hours working on the project outside of class, they never expected their History Day project to win the statewide contest in their division. But when they found out they were headed to nationals and the Smithsonian,
we put in so much effort, and we knew that it was like, we were like, that was a job well done because we spent so much time on it.
The exhibit also features a piece of the actual wall that once divided Germany. For National History Day, students conduct original research on a topic of their choice. They then work to create an exhibit, performance, documentary, essay, or website explaining their research and compete on a local, district, and statewide level in different divisions before advancing to nationals. Adam Johnson, the group's social studies teacher, says the contest helps his students develop the research skills they need for high school.
They have their own project. They have to do their own research. They have to find primary and secondary sources, and they have to use that research to create a project. It's really higher level thinking.
Johnson says what made this group stand out was their diligence.
Their research was spot on. They were passionate about the project, and they worked well together as a group. On top of that, they made a display that looked like a museum exhibit.
Kohlberg and the others say that studying the Berlin Wall is particularly important to them, given current events.
It was important, and it was a pretty major event, and it's still relatively recent, where there's people who have actually been impacted by it, like still living today.
Neither is sure yet what they'll go on to study, but they haven't ruled out history. In Anchorage, I'm Erin McKinstry.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Erin McKinstry, Zachariah Hughes, and Casey Grove in Anchorage, Adlin Baxter and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Aaron Bolton in Homer, and Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA. ACPE's Education Loan Refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.